It's an Nahum Siegel Network, and you are listening to this segment entitled By the Book. I want to thank our friends at Koren Publications, who always provide for us incredible guests here during this segment, and today is no exception. With us in studio is Harav Adin Evan Yisrael Steinsaltz. Harav Steinsaltz, who is certainly well-known to this audience and has been publishing for many, many decades, especially in the area of Talmud and many other areas as well, is out with a brand new book entitled My Rebbe. It is a an amazing account of the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his lifetime. 20 years later, after the Rebbe's passing, Harav Steinsaltz has released this book entitled My Rebbe, which we'll discuss today in this conversation. Harav Adin Evan Yisrael Steinsaltz, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Nahum Siegel Network.
Thank you, and I hope it will be informative, educational, and perhaps not too boring.
I am sure it'll be all the above except for the boring part. We should start, because so many of our listeners, of course, are in pain, maybe not as much as the people of Israel and the state of Israel and the families of the three boys, but we know that some of the boys who are victims of this most recent kidnapping are students of yours in your yeshiva in the Gush in Israel. So
yes.
I don't know if there's anything comforting that we can say or anything that you could tell us.
Unluckily, I just had a phone call from Israel today, half an hour ago, nothing new, which is, it's really, look, the whole thing about the kidnapping was, it was a big shock. And, two of them are really little boys, they are 16 years old, say. The older one is 19, which again, also a yeshiva boy. Not from my yeshiva, but they went together. So this whole thing was in a way shocking, frightening, and of course, in Israel, not only in Israel, but luckily perhaps still the Jewish people have this kind of a family feeling. So I had possibly, it's not a great story, but a woman that usually comes to listen to me comes after the lecture, comes to me in tears. She said, she's not a little lady. She's not a little girl. And she's a mother of five. And she says, she's studying. She says, I cannot sleep at night because of these boys. So she has nothing to do with them.
Right.
But, so that is, it's kind of a sample that you get to get to know. And, but it's true about everybody. But so that is one point. Now, what is in a certain way, it was a very professional job on their side, very professional. It's also still of some kind of enigmatic, because in most cases, after they kidnap somebody, they announced gleefully that they did it and who did it and what that group or faction wants as a payment for the kidnap. So up to now, we didn't hear one thing from the kidnappers, which is, in so many ways, perhaps more frightening. It makes people more nervous. Not that whatever they may want will make life easier. The problems then of, see, the demands they make and the payments that our people did in the past are, both of them are shocking.
Right.
But as it is for the time being, the fact that everything is wrapped in darkness, real darkness. And I know that's not divulging secret information, but there's thousands of soldiers are going all over the area. But it's not one town, but a whole region. And a region that is basically with a fair amount, more than the usual amount of animosity towards Israel. Which means that in other places you have different people. So somebody may tell that what's happening. there the majority is really for the kidnapping. So that makes it much harder. And it's what I call a mountainous area, mm-hmm. which contains, among other things, it's not old like in New York, when some of the antiquities are 200 years old.
Right.
So there you have 4,000 years old, which means you never know about the caves and the underground implements and all kinds of old buildings. It's really full of all kinds of mysteries. Nobody knows all of these. So our army is trying to get anything, anywhere. Doesn't, so far, it seems that we have this, again, it's just an assumption. The assumption is they're still in the place where they're, which means in the Hebron area,
right.
which is big enough. And our people are searching, and hoping for some breakthrough.
Have you thought about what the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, would have said in the aftermath of this episode?
Well, this was an unusual event, because it was, I won't say that it was a time of quiet. We have times of what I call, say,
relative quiet.
But basically, but it wasn't, at least we didn't know about, which the army now releases, how many attempts for kidnapping were in the past.
Right.
So this was successful, but it doesn't mean that they didn't try it before.
Right.
It seems to be for Israel.
Right.
It's just we say, even though you are not possibly the good recipient, but possibly some of your listeners can transmit it later on.
Right.
The goyim say that that's all of the shows that Israel can understand all the force. It is just the opposite. It is not a show of force. It's a show of paradise on their side, and it shows on the other side, it shows how merciful we are, how sensitive we are, because otherwise we could tell them like any good American government would tell them go to hell.
Right.
So the fact that it's not a show of, it's not their force, it is just, it's a kind of a very dirty kind of blackmail.
Right.
And
that we as a people are not really used to, or at least every time it happens, it's shocking to us. Let's put it that way.
It's not shocking. Right. We know it is. Right. It's a part of. See, we were to quote the Gemara. See, when the Melamed hangs the whip on the wall, who is scared?
Right.
Those boys who get whipped continuously. So whenever there is a whip, we are always scared.
Right. The reason I brought up the Rebbe in an attempt to transition to the book that you wrote is because he was quite outspoken about the way one should be dealing with the enemy and the way one's attitude should be toward Eretz Israel and to an extent the state of Israel in general.
Yes, look, he said, and it was in a strange way, his attitude about everything from the inhabitants of Canaanites to points of religion. He said that yielding and giving away is not a way of gaining, not any gains, and not a way of having any kind of permanent situation settlement. So he said that the more you show yourself giving and yielding, it doesn't hold. Let me just use something that I'm using for many years, so again, in more than one area. See, when you have to deal with a dog, dogs are almost have a built-in instinct to attack somebody that flees from them. Once you stand against the dog and you threaten the dog will stand still. So it's in many ways that was his attitude,
right.
That you cannot, the fleeing is not a solution.
And that when you say included Crown Heights, the proof is in the pudding. One of the few Jewish neighborhoods that stayed with a Jewish core because of his attitude.
And that was he stood there, And he told more or less, they told the people whatever they have to do. So, which means that they have to stay and to be firm. And then eventually it will settle down. Right. Now the neighborhood is just to speak about Kaunite, and again, the Rebbe was surely not a racist by any means. And it didn't bother him that there are a few black people around the neighborhood, a few Hispanics. He wanted to keep the majority and the constituency of the place as it was. So now the place is settled, more or less settled, and it's a safe place. And it seems that also the non-Jewish inhabitants really appreciate it as it is now.
No question. So
I'm saying that would be his position in general, that giving up, yielding, is never a good policy.
HaRav Adin Evan Yisrael Steinsaltz is here. The book is called My Rebbe. I think on a previous occasion we had discussed how Talmudists often are wordsmiths. What do I read into the fact that the title of this book is My Rebbe, as opposed to any other title you could use to indicate that it's a biography of a great man?
Well, the real answer would be it would kill the nice compliment you gave me. You see, I wanted to give it a different title. That is the title that was forced on me by the publisher.
Hmm.
So the publisher thought it would be better selling. The publisher may be right, and they cannot fight the publisher.
But the title doesn't misrepresent your...
No, surely right. Not. I'm just saying...
It's a good one. It just may not
then
be good.
I've been thinking about it. It was what I call a good gimmick. but is it what... See, the point is, basically, is not just... It is not an autobiography of myself. I'm not trying to, but still, there is clearly in there a personal aspect, so it has a meaning.
Right. Would your life have been a lot different if you never would have met the Lubavitcher Rebbe?
Oh, very much. Very much. In many ways. In many ways, in the things that I did and things that I didn't do. See, I once told him, I had an urgent question too that I had to answer, and I was in doubt. So, and I told him, possibly you had some of you Hasidim were more, say, vociferous, and they everybody knew how great Hasidim they are.
Right.
I am not. But one thing is, if I'm asking you, I'm going to obey any answer you give me, which I did. So
right.
Now, so it was in many cases it could have changed my life one way or the other way. This was clear about personal, very personal problems, about more general questions.
Right. Yes. With all the volumes that you've published over the years, did you go to him when one was complete to show it to him,
in fact, if I didn't, it would sometimes it happened that I wrote something in a journal. And didn't send it to him. He complained to me. Why didn't you send? You published something, but you didn't send it to me. So I made it a point.
I'm so glad you brought that up. What is it? How can you describe his ability, his what seemed to be a superhuman ability, to keep track of more things than anybody else could, to have more energy than the average person ever could when it came to standing and giving dollars or spending the entire night with people like yourself? Mm-hmm. How does one explain that type of superhuman?
The best way is not to explain it. See, all those explanations are usually untrue. See? There was something superhuman about him, not in the sense that he had wings.
Right.
See, we don't even know.
But he didn't fatigue like the rest of us, it seems.
I don't know. See, he didn't give up. See, he slept so very little that some of it can be accounted that I don't know how a human being could survive.
Right.
He didn't have any kind of regular, what are called times of rest. Never. He once, he was once asked why, like so many rebbes before him, including his father-in-law, they used to take some kind of a rest period. And he said, if you would work more, I could afford myself to rest. So
he felt it upon himself.
He felt that the thing has to be done. Right. And if other people don't do it, he's doing it.
I asked this to some of his shluchim recently. How difficult, and maybe it's not difficult, but in your evaluation, how difficult is it for these shluchim around the world to continue to accomplish when they know that their leader, whether during the era that he was here or now, demanded so much and always felt that no matter how much was accomplished, there's so much more that needs to be done?
Well, that's the burden of the shaliach. That's also the power of the shaliach. Shaliach, look, just make a comparison between, say, a rabbi in a town.
Right.
And a shaliach in a town. The rabbi in a town gets lots of support. And sometimes he's fighting with the people. And sometimes he's not, the people are not, don't like him, whatever it is. And so, he's moving out. Basically, a shaliach of Chabad, once he gets to a place, he knows that there he is to the end. I mentioned in my book, suppose that my brother-in-law was for many years a shaliach in a godforsaken country in Morocco. For many, many years. So after, I say, 30-odd years, he sent to the Rebbe a letter, and he says, just the number of Jews in Morocco dwindled. See, it became perhaps 1% of what it was. Possibly, you should send me to another place. See, he didn't want to...
Time to move on.
he just said them, right. And the Rebbe answered him, a very nice answer. He said, the captain of the ship is the last person to leave the ship. So he stayed to his death.
And you actually compared the Rebbe to a captain as well.
Yes, but I'm saying...
I understand. He felt every shliach is a captain who doesn't leave.
You are in a place... Right. Now, that means it's a very different attitude. The attitude which means you are under obligation, and you are an obligation that is never finished because you are in a way... Look... Even the basic responsibility notion. See, if you are a rabbi in the ex-Orthodox synagogue or in the ex-conservative temple, okay, you are there. You have your people, and you're responsible for your people. If you are a Chabad shaliach, you are responsible for those who go to the Orthodox shul. And those who go to the Reformed Temple, and even more so to those who don't go to any of these places. So that is, you see, you come to a small place. How many Jews are in the place? In most cases, not in America as well as in many other places, you really don't know how many there are. Because for each one that is apparent as a Jew, you have one that is, some that are Maranos. For habit's sake.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are just for custom, for convenience, so you don't know about them. Now, if you are supposed to be a shaliach of the Rebbe that is interested in every person, and I just can tell you personally, but some of those people that went out where whatever to do whatever they are doing, I would say, instead of him, let them go to hell quietly and silently. Why should you bother them in the middle by putting on tefillin on them? See, why should you bother them? But he never accepted this.
Right.
I mean, whoever you are, whatever you are, whatever it is, I'm not now going to speak about his miracles, A young man came to him from France, he came to the Rebbe to ask because he married a non-Jewish wife.
Right.
What should he do? So should he go try to convert her? And so on? Because she seemed to be willing.
Right.
And The Rebbe looked at her and said, you ask your mother who you are.
Ask your mother who you are.
Who you are. And she asked the mother. It took her some convincing. The mother told her that she's a good Jewish girl.
The rabbi had a feeling, a notion.
Yes. Okay, if I put some what I call hot pepper before you, you know what it is.
Right.
See, the rabbi had a notion. Who is a Jew? This is, it depends on what you are interested in. Course.
Understood. Haravadin Evan Yisrael Steinzaltz. The book is called My Rebbe. This is the Nachum Segal Network. The book available from Magid Books, our friends at Koren Publications. Check it out, korenpub.com. Is he responsible for the name Evan Yisrael?
No, that's the Rebbe.
The Rebbe is responsible for the name Evan Yisrael.
Yes,
Was he in general a name-changing Rebbe? I don't remember that being. Yeah.
Never.
So how?
I remember it was... First of all, it was, as far as I know, the only case in which he changed somebody's last name.
And the reason was?
No reason. He just says to me in a very... You see, he was, in general also, people didn't know him. But in private you could see it more. He was a person with lots of humor.
People he had a sense of humor.
Oh, very much so. He didn't use it much in the for the big public. He possibly thought that he won't understand it, but in private he would much more. But then he calls me back. I was passing there in one of those dollar trips.
Right.
He calls me back, which was astonishing, and he says, you know that my way is to interfere in other people's business. This was
okay.
Exactly these words. And said, I think that you should change your name to a Hebrew name. It says, you shouldn't change the name of the Stein is Evan something. And there were even Ezra, even Gabirol and other Evans. Yeah. So you can change your name along this line.
And you chose the second part, Yisrael.
Yes, I chose the part and he approved of it. Everything was all right. But I'm just saying it was his deed. And it caught me. Everybody, see, as it is there, you know, it's a big community. It's given to rumors, and within 2 minutes they had a dozen explanations. why was it? And most of them were ridiculous, but none of them was true. But that was that. So
and people are figuring out the gematria of Evan Yisrael.
Possibly they do it to this day. I don't.
I can only imagine. At what is there a way to tell this audience that there was a point in the early 50s when he became Rebbe where he started showing signs that he could be this leader of generations? Like, was there an episode or something that you could cite where it looked early on like he was going to be the Lubavitcher Rebbe?
Well, there wasn't that. First of all, he was an exceptional person. Exceptional person, among other things, because he was, to the last day almost, he was fighting against the notion of making him a rabbi.
He didn't like it.
He didn't like it. There's a letter of his, a very strong letter, which says, what do you want from me? It's like tearing me limb by limb. Hmm. Like sucking my blood, see? I'm not made for it. But once he took it, he took it. Now, the point was that people didn't know it from the beginning. It was an assembly of qualities that were very unusual. See, possibly nobody else had them. See, he was a great Torah scholar,
mm-hmm.
which was one thing. He had a with it and with about it. He had a very exceptional memory and very quick.
The kids would say he knew everything.
He knew everything.
Simple as that.
In many ways.
Right.
So that was one thing. Then he really knew also the world, which most of the religious leaders didn't know, surely not as far and as deep as he did. And which was there from the very beginning was you could see it, the enormous, what's the power within it, the energy, the big notion, which was that he is not going to hide behind any kind of a ghetto walls.
Right.
He's going to attack.
He'll be open and out.
He's going to attack. So that was made the difference. An acquaintance of mine was one of the first that wrote about the Rebbe in a big way, in a general press. He already remarked it in the early years.
Right.
So it became very, very, very clear from the time on.
And you use the word attack, and sure enough, the army metaphors with the Tzivos Hashem and all, those are all, I guess, from him, right? Those were all, he really did consider these people to be an army for him and for God.
He was speaking about it in many ways. And one of his points was, there's a difference between a person who's a worker, or a lover, or a person, a son. But there's something else which is, see, a soldier is connected, is under orders and so on. But the soldier is ready to give his life. So that's a very...
The ultimate sense of purpose.
Yes, that is, right. And that is what he tried to do.
Right, we will sacrifice to get this mission done. The Mivtzaim,
exactly.
Right?
Yes, exactly.
With those words,
okay.
Right?
You send them, and they go, and okay, some of them are maimed in moving, but still, you still go on.
Right. What about the attraction then to people who were not Lubavitch, who were not Chabad Hasidim? Why were so many government officials and so many non-Jews throughout this country and the world so attracted to him?
Look, there are, as I wrote in this book, there are many people who are famous. There are very few people who are great. So when people, even when they don't make a big research about it, know who is great. So people are attracted to greatness. There are not so much greatness in the world. I mean, I don't want to say anything bad about your president and your former president and the former president, but you will possibly allow me to say that none of them is a great man. They are famous, some of them are good looking, and some of them had nice stories behind them to make them noteworthy, but they are not great men.
Right.
And so it's the same thing about most scientists and most religious leaders.
And his greatness made him attractive to everybody, from the average person to people that held high positions.
As I said just recently about it, when you encounter a mountain like the Everest,
right,
you don't have to measure it by meters. Right. You get a notion where you are and what you are standing.
You get the idea that it's quite a big mountain.
Yes.
Rav Adin Evan Yisrael Steinsaltz, the book is called My Rebbe. What about the timing of this? Is it unusual that it's 20 years later? Would this not have been written 5 years after his passing?
It is completely not connected.
It is arbitrary.
It is arbitrary. I tried to explain a little bit, perhaps in introduction. It was a book that was very hard for me to write. In fact, I had offers to begin to write it in his lifetime. In his lifetime. But it took for me a great effort, and it was done like cutting pieces from a living body.
Right.
So it took a long time. And I had to finish it sometime, not because of the date, but because even a very patient publisher gets impatient after some time. See, he says, okay, 1 year and a second year and a third year, how long does it go? So I had to finish it somewhere.
You're generally, when you're outspoken on the issue of Mashiach, you're generally skeptical of those who consider the Rebbe Mashiach till this point, but during his lifetime, it seems you had a notion that it's possible that this man could be the Messiah.
I don't see any reason why not. I mean, there wasn't any better candidate, and if you could name any person, you we possibly would try, but you cannot name anybody like this. And as I've mentioned it, I was one of the first that found it by chance, say, in the response of the Chassam Sofer.
Right.
He says, it is one of our points of belief that in every generation there should be at least one person that has all the attributes of becoming Messiah. Because it says Messiah can come any time, which means he has to be ready.
Right.
He has to be. So there is always a person that is ready. So when the order comes, he becomes Messiah. It's like you have to give. It's possibly a good example. You see, you have some very deadly bombs and machines under the hand of the presidents of the United States. He has to push one button.
Right.
And then it is no longer a possible danger. Then it becomes something that destroys the world.
Right.
That's the same thing. See, there is, it should be something. See, an empty box with a red button and it doesn't do it. See, you can hold two such boxes and they won't do any good.
Right.
But see, if there is something, so it means that if the right time comes, the button is pushed. And,
right.
So once he was gone, you witnessed this movement that many still believe,
I know that was very well understood, emotionally, psychologically. People do it with all kinds of close and beloved people.
It's human nature.
It's a human nature. And to deny human nature would be very, very hard. But that was that.
And what do you say then today, 20 years later? Is it regretful that the Rebbe never addressed this issue as he heard the rumors during his lifetime, the way people were speaking about him?
As long as he was alive, he was still hoping. To the last moment, he was hoping.
And that's legitimate. Those who are critical of him for not addressing it,
he was waiting to get the power in.
He was ready.
He was ready. You see, it's like him, as I say, whatever it is, a machine. It is, the machine is ready. It just needs to be connected to the power source.
Chabad, as powerful and as well known as it is today and all the great work they do, would be better off without that whole argument or discussion, or they're just fine the way they are right now?
Well, I really don't know, because Chabad somehow managed to pass. See, this last 20 years are in itself. If one doesn't have to look at least, if you want to see a miracle of the Rebbe, the existence of Chabad is clearly a miracle. It is every rational researcher this said that within 2 years the movement will disappear.
Right. So. And sure enough, here it is, probably, I guess you could say, stronger than ever.
It's bigger.
One of the things that people are always fascinated with is private discussions with the Rebbe. You alluded to it earlier in terms of his sense of humor. Is there something groundbreaking, earth-shattering that you could share with us that was said to you only in private?
If it was something that was earth-shattering, and illuminating the world, it's either so private that I don't have to tell it,
right,
or it is something that I have already told. So it's surely when I know that you are you're meeting all kinds of people, some of them I'm afraid are all kinds of small range, small size politicians. And you want them to tell the secret that nobody heard. Now, those people tell you the secret. You only despise them.
Understood. But is there then an encounter that you would bring up as an example of something that was unique, different, even if you've shared it in other forum before, that was, you know, something that was said to you privately, or an encounter that you had for many hours late at night that made an impression on you at the Rebbe?
It was usually jumping from one subject to another and making decisions he's making suggestions.
So it was always, it was rapid fire, topic to topic. That was
basically it. It didn't sound like this, but it was basically something that were many topics were covered. And as I say, he used to say sometimes when somebody misunderstood him, he said, my suggestions are like somebody else's orders.
Right. So, a subtle way of saying he advises you follow the advice.
He's saying, no, you know, there are some people that when they advise you, you follow this advice.
Right.
Some people come to you with a pair of guns, and they advise you to pull everything out of your pockets.
Right.
You don't have to be threatened. You do it with just simple advice.
Right. See? One of the criticisms that's often levied against Chabad is that, as an example, when they're raising their children, they might say to them, you know, do this mitzvah for the Rebbe. When, of course, in Jewish tradition, mitzvahs are normally done, you know, for the glory of God, etc.
Look, if you have a family, possibly, I saw some signs
right.
of that. So sometimes you tell a little baby, eat this piece of bread for your mama, and that is for grandpa, and that's the way that you deal with little children. See, you give them something, a more tangible image.
So you would say that when those kids grow up, they know they're serving God. They're just in the Rebbe's army.
That's what it is. But as you say, when your children, it doesn't seem that they need it. Too much brooding about eating, but if
I'll take that as a compliment. You must know that their mother's a good cook.
Well, it sometimes shows that, or it shows that the genetics is more powerful than what I call the negative advertisement. But anyway, what I'm just saying is that, of course, you have people grow up, and you know. You are not eating anymore for the sake of mama, and not for the sake of a little brother, and not even the sake of the puppy. So you grow up. That is a part of growing up.
Understood. Another criticism that's often said about the whole effort that Chabad makes on the streets around the world is the. I don't know the pushiness, the overall enthusiasm that they approach Jews with about performing certain mitzvahs, about lighting Shabbos candles and things like that. Do you see anything negative about that type of approach with people who are unaffiliated?
Look, some people don't like it, and some people don't do it. But basically, living in America, and to say that. Seems to me completely not according to the type in America, in which aggressive advertisement is not the exception but it's the rule,
right.
In which advertisement is in itself a holy object in itself. When you do, you are aggressive in points that are immoral and illegal. So you say it about Chabad, which are doing it comparatively speaking, very low key.
I never thought of it that way.
But think about it.
Right, of course.
Just compare it to the McDonald's. Say.
Right. Understood. In fact, it's funny because they do say that the only thing that's in every city in the world is Coca-Cola and Chabad. So I guess people.
Yes. So, but it, you see, Coca-Cola does some advertisement.
That's true. If it's good enough for them, I guess it's good enough for Chabad as well. Is there a? There was a great mix. At least it seemed that way of the Rebbe's attitude toward Israel, for instance, but other areas as well, and politics. In other words, he felt it was his role, if I have this correct, to influence public officials a certain way.
Yes.
To view them as not just leaders in politics, but leaders of people who should be making moral decisions and biblical decisions when it came to Israel. And he had no regrets about that, right? If the Israeli prime minister is standing in front of him, he'll clearly make it known to him what mistakes he feels he's making.
Well, usually it's going the other way around. See, when he met the Israeli prime ministers, they were usually in awe.
Understood.
So,
wouldn't the Rebbe point out to them some of the things that they should be rethinking? Or
very much.
Yeah.
Some of them were done in public,
right.
And some of them were done. So, see, look, if you feel that you're responsible because of your position, not always of your position. You have, there's something that you have to make to correct. Whether it's a spelling mistake, or a political mistake, or a huge tactical move. So if you are a watcher and you think that I saw somebody making a mistake, so you correct it. Right. I remember many years ago it was an exchange of letters with a person that became very friendly, Lova Eliav. Don't know if you know the name.
Sure.
He was an important personality in Israeli public life.
Right.
And he writes to him about what's called Kav Barlev, the Barlev line in the Suez Canal.
Right.
And the Rebbe writes to him completely on a basic, say, on a military basis. He says, since the Second World War, we know that such fortified lines never have any value. It's just an effort that has no result, and so on and so on. And it says, the only thing, then he adds, he says, I don't know if it's humor or cynical, he says, the only thing that you can say is that the soldiers standing on the seashore have some fun by seeing other people working and building the things. But I don't know, he says, if to make a little fun for the soldiers, it's worth to put on billions of dollars in it.
Understood. A great military point.
Yes.
You have a chapter that I have not yet read entitled The Rebbe's Loneliness.
Yes.
Now, is that more of the Rebbe's loneliness because it's lonely at the top, or is that more about the unfortunate situation that he was not able to, that he did not build his own family?
It's a connection.
So tell me about not having a next generation, how that affected him.
It was clearly, see, had he had a son, daughter, even a daughter, it would make a big difference. It would make a big difference in the attitude, also perhaps in a small way, even in the notion of the urgency. Of the urgency, see. When you know that somebody is going to take over.
And him knowing that there would be no one to take over.
It makes things much more urgent, and it was also loneliness. Look, it was not just being on top. But everybody on top is lonely. But being on top and see, you president can find people that can talk with him in the same level.
Right.
Quite a number of people. They may not be as powerful. If Obama meets Putin, he cannot say that Putin is less intelligent or less sharp.
Similar levels.
They're similar levels.
Right.
They're different people, but similar levels.
Right.
So the point about the Lubavitcher Rebbe was, among other things, there were fewer and fewer people that he could talk with his friends. See, it makes life much harder that you don't have people that are equally in the same level of you. See, you can talk with them, and you can ask them and get the answers of them. It is a very unusual position, and people, especially when they are involved in their spiritual life, feel it much more. He could chat with everybody, and he chatted. Some of the people that came to him were all kinds of people. Some of them were not great minds or great in anything, but he could chat with them as a person can chat and not be lonely when you have a little child or anything around you. But sometimes you want to have a company.
Wow.
That is a very hard situation. That's what I wrote about it. See, there were several people like this in our history. And each of them suffered from it.
Right. And the passing of his wife... Anybody would be devastated, obviously, if they have a loving wife when she's no longer there, but that's part of this whole picture that you described.
Yes, I said because she was in many ways what people deplored, say, kind of a life she had. because she was, see, both of them, as private people, they preferred to stay private people. Right. He was forced to be public. And so he had his picture in any place, in any right and wrong place. Her picture you hardly ever saw.
Right.
You didn't see her. You hardly ever saw her. But on the other hand, she was not just a girl that he picked up in the street. She was a daughter of a rabbi. And she had all the notions like Lavdil. Like the Queen Elizabeth.
Right.
See? So it was, she could.
They could relate to each other.
So they could relate to each other in a certain way, like equals.
Right.
See? And so it wasn't that she was given her life for a man, for a great man. She gave her life up for somebody that was an embodiment of everything she believed in.
Right.
So. It's a very different thing. Very few people had the same thing.
Unbelievable. You mentioned about the desire for someone to be able to speak to somebody. It seems to me, maybe I'm just reading too much into it. When I see certain videos of the Rebbe meeting great minds, people of great stature, who you know he would enjoy a conversation with, it seems he has a special glow to him. I'm thinking.
Yes, he just liked it. You see, he look. Everybody likes it when you have somebody to talk with. See, hey, you are living in a jungle, and the closest creatures to you are apes, intelligent apes, okay, and very very friendly apes.
You're dying to meet a human being.
Yes, exactly.
Understood. And finally, one of the things that almost always comes up at the Shluchim conferences when public speeches are made and any time the Rebbe's life is discussed is his time management. He had a unique ability, it seemed, from those who observed him closely, to never waste a minute, in addition to the lack of fatigue and the incredible energy and the many hours every day compared to other human beings, but just the time management. And that's why I'm so intrigued by the way you described your discussions with him, that, you know, if it needed to be short so that you can move on to a next
time. Yes, it was short. If it was short, it could do it within a second. If it has to be, you have to say, see, it's like music. Have you ever listened to a symphony? Mm. It goes in different moods. Some of them are what we call lento. And some of them are very fast. Some of them are staccato. So does it make a contradiction in the fact that the musician writes this kind of music? In some ways you have this melody or this move, this tone has to put slowly, and the other one has to be fast. It makes sense in itself.
Will we ever have a leader like him again?
We never know. We always hope. At least we can hope. See, that's the point of having. See, we had, in some ways, we can say some of our leaders in the past didn't have any real replacement.
Right.
That is one thing. On the other hand, you have sometimes people that had a replacement. Sometimes astonishing, sometimes you weren't prepared to it, but see, there's always a hope. See, it's a hope because there's a need. See, let's imagine that okay, Mashiach comes and the world comes to a more or less way. Not to a, I wrote about it. Mashiach, coming of Mashiach means the end of history. So a different world. In that different world, you don't need the same kind of just not only charismatic but outstanding people. Okay? You have everything is nice, quiet, simple, and possibly you can have it a different way. Now, perhaps Mashiach is also in a hurry. if you make any calculations, see, Mashiach is in a hurry to go to the next step, and he has to deal with the people. and it's not easy to deal with the people. So he has to, from time to time, after doing all kinds of good things, making peace, making quiet, and so on, then now he has to begin to kick them. See, it's not enough to sit quietly
right.
and I call smoke a pipe.
I can't thank you enough for being here today.
Thank you.
Congratulations, if I may say, on the brand new book, My Rebbe. Mm-hmm. And not that a compliment in this area for me would mean much, but I can tell you as a regular balabas, as the expression goes, your most recent volumes of the Talmud just become more and more beautiful and more pleasant to explore, and I'm sure that was one of your goals in terms of the recent projects.
Sure, sure, sure.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an amazing segment of Buy the Book. Our friends at Koren Publications, go to korenpub.com. It's a Magid Books release with the Shefa Foundation. It's called My Rebbe, Harav Adin Eben Yisrael Steinsaltz, visiting us here on this amazing edition of Buy the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network. I thank you for tuning in, for being part of this. And my thanks to Harav Adin Eben Yisrael Steinsaltz from all of us here at the Nachum Segal Network. Thank you.